family. I'm Ursula, I'm an addict. And I was a little nervous, and I'm still a little nervous. And I just want to thank the Central Maryland region of the Chesapeake and Potomac region for thinking of me. And I want to thank Brian Kay for having faith in me when I didn't have faith in myself. I ain't supposed to cry yet. But, you know, I need to tell y'all, you know, coming down here was a journey itself, you know. You know, yesterday we started out at 11:30 coming here. And we got like maybe 40 minutes out into Calvert, and the car breaks down. And the guy says, we stopped at this place. We didn't know it was a lawnmower place. It just looked like a gasoline station. And the man said, go 500 yards and you'll find a Mr. Tire, right? So we get there and they tell us that my problem is that we had a double seal on the oil change thing, and so they took that off and they replaced that, and we get like another maybe, what, 15 minutes, and the car says, kuh-kuh, and it goes down. And so now we're wondering, what's going on? We just got this thing fixed, and the guy said, you know, normally this will cost you like $20-something, but we only charge you $14. So I called them back, and we had to get a tow truck to come get the vehicle. And, you know, I kept thanking God that we started out a day early. I thank God that we only made it to Calvary because we live in St. Mary's, right? That it wasn't on 50, that we were coming down here and had broken down. And so the tow truck come to get us, and he took us from one side of the street to the other side of the street, and he charged me $75. I told him I wasn't too happy with that price, you know. But because, you know, I didn't go off, I just kept thanking God and I kept praying, and it worked out. It worked out that we got here yesterday. I think it's awesome. So anyway, again, I'm Ursa and I'm an addict, and I'm really just glad to be here. And you know, I remember as a little girl, growing up, and I grew up in a single-parent home. My father was an alcoholic, and my mother raised me to the best of her ability. And she didn't keep my father out of my life. You know, I was able to see him. You know, he never hit his girls, but I saw him beat women. And I used to say, you know, if he would just stop drinking, you know, he wouldn't be so mean. And my mother didn't talk bad about him. You know, I remember saying, I'm just not going to ever be an alcoholic. I'm never going to be an alcoholic. And but you couldn't tell my father he was an alcoholic. You know what I'm saying? And he was the sweetest man. I'm telling you, the sweetest man you would ever want to meet. And actually, he's instrumental in the way that my character is today. I never heard my father say, I love you, until the day before he died. And I remember just growing up, and my mother, you know, of course she wants to give me the best. She wants to make sure that I have everything that she didn't have, so I had everything I needed, I wanted, and more. And through that, I learned that when you said no, I had a problem with no. You know, it wasn't that my mother didn't teach me love. She didn't teach me how to be responsible. She didn't teach, she did all that as a parent should do. She made sure I was in dance. She made sure I was in karate. You know, whatever I said I wanted to do, my mother provided that. And see, I didn't see that then, but, you know, she worked two jobs plus went to school to support me. And I ain't realized that. So I remember as a little girl, you know, I was tall for my age. And I always wanted to do what the older people did. I always wanted to hang around the older crowd because I look older. You know what I'm saying? I had the body, but my mind was still a child. And so, I just wanted to do what the older people did. I wanted to go out. You know, I'm 12. You know, let me start out. I started lying when I was early in my childhood. And I remember I was in third or fourth grade, and I would say that I was 1 year older than what I was. I always said that. And then I used to tell people I stayed back in first grade, right? And and that lie I carried, and I carried, and I carried. Of course, when I got older, my family was my father's side, their kids and us, his kids and me. We grew up together. My uncle's kids and me, we grew up together. And, whatever they always say, the Ursa, you started me smoking cigarettes, you know. And now that I got clean, I said, I didn't start you smoking cigarettes. You started on your own, you know. You just saw me, though, right? And they were older than me, you know. So I just remember the cigarettes. And I remember my mother, she used to smoke then. And when she was ready to light her cigarette, I would say, Mom, let me light your cigarette for you, you know. And she would say, don't burn my cigarette up, you know. And the whole time she didn't know I was back there, I was puffing the cigarette. You know what I'm saying? And that started me on my journey with cigarettes. That wasn't her fault. That's something I just decided to do, you know. Cigarettes led to my next drug, which was marijuana. And I thought that was just it for me. I was going to be old. I was going to be in a rocking chair smoking marijuana. And I remember when my mother first found out, she said, that leads into something else. And I said, that ain't going to lead to nothing else. And at the time, I ain't know nothing about, the other drugs, really. That's all I knew. I was like, well, it ain't going to lead to nothing else, you know. I remember just not feeling good about me, ever. I was tall. I was always taller than the other people. My lips still big, but now they're beautiful, right? I could find all the things that was wrong with me. You know, one aunt used to call me skinny. One aunt used to call me slim. She still calls me that today. One aunt used to say I was thin, so I've never been a heavy person, you know. But those names used to bother me, you know. Why can't they just say my name? You know what I'm saying? She's so thin, you know. Man, cover something. Anyway, through those years, I was an honor roll student. I graduated from high school, and, I went off to business college. Before I went to business college, I got in a relationship with this guy, and it was back in the early 80s, and I was introduced to my next substance, and that was coke. And, back then it was freebasing, and I thought I was on. And they said that was a rich man's high. So I really thought I had done some things, and I was on my way. And little did I know that I would get my ass whipped on the regular, you know, that he would beat me so brutally, you know. And that I would keep going back. I would keep going back to the same man who would whip me, you know, and 'cause I loved him. I love that man, I thought, you know. And, so from that, I was working in the government, and they said I had a problem. And I said, I don't have a problem, really, you know. But in order to keep my job, I had to go to some counseling, you know. And I remember going in there thinking that, okay, I can go to a couple sessions, and I'm good. Little did I know I would be stealing the money from the job, you know, and they let me go. I don't know why they let me go. You know, so I left that job, and I decided if I leave that man if I leave that man, I would be all right. I won't get high, and I really won't get beaten. You know what I'm saying? And I remember stopping using coke, but I continued to smoke marijuana. And then I added a little something else in there. I added some wine in there, and I was all right. You know what I'm saying? And it wasn't until years later, you know, it was just some years later, that now, you know, we all hanging out, and I also remember my mother saying to me, she said, baby, you're trying to do everything when you're young. And she said, when you get older, you ain't going to have nothing to do. And I remember the friends that are, you know, my cousins and stuff, and the people that have become my friends now, you know, we decide now, you know, we're going to meet at each other's house, we're going to play cards, because we've done all the clubs. We did the party scene. So now let's get together, play cards, let's, you know, play Scrabble, let's do something and get high. And so back then, I would take the marijuana, and then I had to add something else on top of it. And when that ran out, I knew what to do. When the marijuana ran out, I knew what to do with the coke. And my addiction took off. And I didn't even know it was addiction then, you know. And it took off so fast, you know. And I remember just saying, you know what, I had done the freebase thing back there. I know what it can lead to, but still doing it anyway. And I remember, by now I have had a son, and I'm at home with my mother. And because I still had money, you know, because I had worked a job and I was able to get some retirement, and you can borrow from that retirement, and that's what I did. And so because I continued to have money, and, you know, even though I wasn't working anymore, I was at home, and my son was there, and I was there, you know, sometimes I was there. And I just remember, you know, like my mother looking at me one day. You know, first she said to me one day, she said, baby, she said, you know, I think you really need some help. And I said, you know, my wife, why would you say that? And she said, you know, I came in the room the other night, and I looked at your bed, and I said, Lord, where is she, right? And she said, I thought your covers were just, you know, messed up. And she said, and I went over there, and I touched the covers, and that was you. You know, and I still say I ain't had no problem. You know, and then I remember her saying, you know, one day I was, I'm talking to her, and you know, when I'm in the grip, it don't matter if you're my mother or anybody else. If you say something to hurt me, I'm gonna hurt you, and I mean with the tongue. You know what I'm saying? But this time I couldn't say nothing back. She said, "Baby, you know what? You're a dressed up garbage can." And I said, why would you say that? You know, and I'm steady pinning up clothes, you know, and I'm putting other stuff under here because I got to go to work, you know, and I'm going to work sometimes, you know, but I'm going to work, you know. And then one day she called me a crackhead. And that thing hurt me to the core. And, you know, the only thing I could say to her is like, why you got to call me a crackhead? I just like to smoke crack. What's wrong with that? You know, how insane is that? But that's what I said to her, and she just looked at me like, you know, you have lost your mind. You know, and so it wasn't long after that, my stepfather was in the home. My mother got married, and my stepfather was in the home, and he said, you know, like, you know, I'm going to give you a suggestion. He said, I work with somebody, and they're in this program, and it's called Narcotics Anonymous. And he said, you know, like, why don't you try that? And I was like, yeah, okay. And I went to my first meeting, and it was a Friday night, and two guys shared, and I cried the whole night, but I thought that maybe I'll stay. And what happened was I left out of there, and I continued to use. And the things I heard that night I had not yet done. But it wasn't long, and I was... You know, I was stealing. I was committing credit card fraud. Using counterfeit money. I like that. I like getting things that don't cost anything. And if I can use yours, it would be good for me. And that's what I continue to do, you know. And I just remember that, you know, after that, I would use Narcotics Anonymous meetings as a way to get out of the house. Because it could take me an hour and a half to get where I'm going and come back. And I'd be all right. And needless to say, it wasn't too long after that that I ended up stealing money from my mother. And, you know, because see, what had happened was, you know, the guy beat me. And when the guy beat me, I ain't had no more money. So I had to take her money. And when she came home, I had already prepared myself because I knew what would happen. And so I prepared myself to go somewhere, and I kept calling all these places, and they say, well, we can't get you till Monday. I was like, I need help now, you know. And I called this one place. They said, you can come in. We won't turn you away. And I went in there, and the doctor said, you know, he said, Miss Allen, there's nothing wrong with you. You just do drugs. And I said, oh, I know. He said, so why? I don't know. Because I like them, you know. And he said, well, there's nothing else we can do for you. We have to let you. I said, I called up here, and they told me that y'all would not turn me away and that I could come up here. And he says, well, the only way we can keep you is if you say you're going to commit suicide. I said, okay. And he said, well, how are you going to do it? And I said, I don't know. And he walks out the room, and he comes back. He said, look, he said, what you going to say is, he said, if you take a bottle of Tylenol, if they let you out of here, you're going to take a bottle of Tylenol. And I said, okay. And I looked at him, I said, you can kill yourself off of Tylenol? He said, yeah, if you take too many of them, you know, like that. And I said, okay, we're fine. And he said, okay, we're going to send you up here. And needless to say, I was on the psych ward. And I looked at him and I said, how crazy are these people? And he looked at me like, you know, you're crazy. And, you know, I got up there and I met some people. And a meeting was brought in. And from Narcotics Anonymous, a meeting was brought in. And I said, ooh, I've been to one of them before. And I was like, wow, you know, I'm going to this meeting, you know. And I get in there, and the counselor guy, he was a recovering addict. And he shared the story with me, and I was like, I can do this. I can stay clean. And I came out, and I stayed clean for 9 months. I got a sponsor, and I didn't use my sponsor. I did use her some, and we did a couple steps. And then I decided that I can go to one meeting a week, and that was my home group. And that, you know, now that I'm working again, and I look better now, and I have friends now, you know, I can only do one meeting a week. And needless to say, after I picked up my 9-month key tag, I was back out using. That was April of 2001 that I made that conscious decision. And it was a day that I'll never forget. And it's a day that the disease never makes me forget. You know, because each year it tells me around this time that I'm not good enough, that I don't know why you're going to those meetings, because you ain't helping nobody. You know, the people at your job, they really don't like you, you know. You need to quit your job, you know. It tells me all that kind of stuff and makes me not feel good about me. But what I know today is the disease is a liar. It is a liar. And I stayed out there for some more months, and, you know, everything I said I would never do, I did. And and I just remember, after going to like 4 psych wards, I mean 4, you know, and leaving one and deciding that, let me back up a little bit. I got another job, right? Another job. And I was working for this transportation company in D.C., and they, you know, see, I didn't know it then, But there was recovering addicts working around me. But because, look, and didn't even know there was like meetings all around the place, you know what I'm saying? But because I ain't tapping to that, I know, you know. And so my job tells me one day, said, we need to get a breathalyzer from you. I was like, ooh, I got them, because I don't drink. And I remember going in there and said, you know, any other person would say, you know, it's coming. That your analysis is coming next, right? But no, not me. I'm going to keep using it. And I remember that day I walked in and they said, we got to take you downtown. And I said, for what? And they said, we need to get a urine from you. And now I'm freaking out because I already know what's going on. And I go to my coworker and I said, girl, and she knew what was going on with me. And I told her and I said, you know, they're going to take me downtown. She said, I ain't even got time to give you no pee. Right? And I said, you know what? It ain't going to be worth it now. You know, like that. And she said, you know what? Just tell her why you're going down there. Just tell the boss why you're going down. And I told her. And this lady shared her experience with me. And they sent me to this place that we dropped off people every day. And so I had to see these bus drivers come up there, right? And I would be out there smoking a cigarette, and the humiliation of them seeing me, you know, because people know when you ain't come to work for a month, you somewhere, right? You ain't got five, but you somewhere. And so they seeing me, and I'm trying to scoot on the side, you know, smoke my cigarette when the bus come up, you know. And, you know, and I would leave out of that place. I would leave out of that place. I had to go for 30 days from 8 to 4:30. And I would leave out that place. And every Friday I would go get high. And I remember calling them on a Thursday, because now it's not every Friday. I'm leaving on Thursday. And I called them on a Thursday and I said, I'm not coming today. I feel like killing myself. I didn't know. I did not know that they were going to call my mother, right? And her and my youngest sister and my cousin would be meeting me at a hotel room. And I have on one shoe. That's my size, and one shoe, that's my girlfriend's size, that wears 7, and I wear 9.5. And I walk out the door, and I see this car, and I see my mother and them walking down the side, because see, we done gone from the glitzy hotel, and now we at the little motel, right? And I walk out there, and I see her, and my sister, my father has 3 girls, and my sister, she walks in and she sees us and she says, and she just falls out on the floor and laughing. And she said, this is not a pretty sight. And I said, well, I don't care what kind of sight it is, I'm not going home with mom. And she said, okay, well, sister, just hold on. Because I still had something left, right? And I wanted to continue. I said, well, mama, you take her home and I'm riding with you. And told my sister that, my little sister. And so my sister got me to her house and I think she just, you know, I don't know. She didn't express a whole lot. She let me do what I had to do. And you know, we talked a little bit. And I remember I said, you know what, I can't go back to that job. And so I went to another psych ward. And this was plush. And it was nice. And I got to stay overnight. And I was loving it. Each time I went someplace, though, I met a recovering addict. And this one lady said, she kept telling me, she said, you know you don't have to use no more. And I said, yeah, I know that. I said, yeah, you know, I used to go to meetings and blah, 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 you know. And she said, I have 10 years. And I said, well, what are you doing here? And she said, I had so much to go on in my life this year. She said, I lost my son, I lost my mother, and she named some other people. And she said, I thought I better check in before I check out. It's like, wow. You know, okay. I left out of there, and I started going back to intensive outpatient, and I started going to meetings, and that's where this journey begins. And I came back in Narcotics Anonymous in November 22nd, 2001. Let me back up. November 18th, I came out of my last psych ward. Actually, I went into my last psych ward, and that particular day, November 17th, I tried to commit suicide, and it didn't happen. And you know, the next day was my son's birthday, and I, you know, when I tried to commit suicide and it didn't work, this man pulls up and he said, "You all right?" By this time, I'm on the side and I'm crying, and I don't know what to do. And my car's in a ditch, and the guy said, "You need some help." I said, "You know, if you could take me to that hospital right there, I'd be all right." And I told this man that I was a recovering. I said I was an addict. I smoke crack, and I said, and I'm pregnant. And the guy took me across the street, and I said, "You know, I don't smell too good." I said, "Because I done pissed on myself, and that was something that I would never do. I can't stand something pissy." And you know, in my addiction, I would just pee anywhere. I would just pee anywhere. So when, by the time I got to, I said, "You might want to put something on your seats or something, because I'm pissy." And the man said, "That's all right, ma'am. That's all right. Thank you." And I'm gonna wrap this up. Anyway, this comes here, and I come back to Narcotics Anonymous. I remember saying to my mother, I called her and I said, "Mom, I'm in a psych ward." And she says, "Okay, me and your son, we're on our way to North Carolina. We'll see you when we get back." That was devastating. And I came back into Narcotics Anonymous, and I did some things. And when I came back, I'm talking about in utter desperation. And I came back in here and I did what was suggested. I didn't talk a whole lot. I had to learn to listen, and then I was able to listen to learn. And y'all told me the steps was the key, and so I started getting into some step work. And my first year, I didn't do any step work, and I don't suggest that. That was for me. I had my baby in the first year that I was here. She's not addicted. I got your back. She's not addicted to crack, thank God. And I'm here. And so I stay here. I'll tell y'all why I stay here, because I don't want to smoke crack. That's one. I don't want to leave my son no more. I don't want to tell him I'm going to take him somewhere, and I don't. I don't want to ever hurt my mother again. And I like being clean today. I love being clean. And, you know, I'm going to say this. I got 3 minutes, right? I'm going to say this. You know, in the course of being here, I've lost, I've had death. It came in threes. My oldest sister, my aunt and my grandfather, they all died in a car accident coming up here. I didn't have to use. My mother was diagnosed with cancer, 2 years ago, I believe it was, and I didn't know how to cope. I didn't know how to deal, but I knew I needed to go to a meeting. And because I didn't have the ability to show her love or compassion, I wouldn't hug her, I wouldn't do anything. And so my mother said I treated her like she had the plague. But you know what, today, I'm there for her, she's in remission, and I keep showing up. And I keep showing up for my son, even though he gets on my nerves. And, you know, I'm here, and since being here, I've gotten many gifts. And y'all told me the promise was freedom from active addiction. And to this day, that's been true. And if I continue to do what y'all tell me to do and continue to work on me, I will stay here. So I'll continue to clean house, trust God, and serve others. And I heard this on the way down here because, you know, we were funky. The greatest power of all is love. Thank y'all for being here.
All right, good afternoon, family. My name is Joseph, still an addict. And we got another speaker. Next speaker to speak on who, what, where, when, how, who, what, why, and how. We got John from the Tri-State region, Pennsylvania. Where are you, John?
All right.
I'm John. I'm an addict. Guess she really means what she said about love. She gave me a kiss on the cheek. All right, go ahead, adjust that mic. You know, when they gave me the topic, who, what, how, and why, first thing that dawned on me was, what happened to the? The traditions are in there, too. And I started thinking about, anytime I ever heard tradition meeting, I always tried to avoid it. And that happens a lot in our fellowship. I don't know. I just brought that up because I'm one of the people that believes. I hear people say, I only have 30 days. That gets under my skin when I hear them put that word only in there. You know, and I believe that we're victims of our own language a lot of times. You know, and if I find a way to say the traditions ain't important, you know, it'll become unimportant. Just like anything else in my life. He said, am I talking too loud or? All right. He introduced me. I'm from Tri-State region. The area I'm from is Laurel Mountain Highlands area. It's up in north central Pennsylvania. My home group is Fan of Flames. I've been clean since April 6th, 1990. And I come down here every year. This is like my little reward for my anniversary. This is the first convention I ever attended in whole, way back in the early 90s. About a month ago, someone called me up and asked me, they wished me happy birthday. And they said they didn't want the day to go by without wishing me happy birthday. And I said, no big deal. I said, all it ever was is an excuse to party, go get high, and whatever else they said about it, because that's really about all it was. And I said, just don't miss next month, because that's really what's important. And I said to them, God gave me a gift with my belly button birthday when I came into the world, and I really disrespected it. I didn't do anything with it. I trashed it, and you know, he graciously gave me a second chance with a new birthday. And what I do with that birthday is my gift back to him. And after I said it, I stopped. I'm like, wow, where did that come from? And I had to think about it. And that really is what I do believe. But it just kind of caught me off guard when I said it. And I've kind of been doing a little bit of searching in the last month about what's been going on and how I'm respecting that gift. And over the last 3 years, my life has become pretty involved with my parents. My parents are 89 and 86, and I'm in a position where I'm now their parent. And before I go any farther, I want to thank the convention for asking me to come down here and share. From the moment I got the phone call, I've felt excited again because I could feel like the enthusiasm drifting out of me for my recovery. With everything I've been doing in the last 3 years, I still get to my home group. I still do H&I every week. I go into two different penitentiaries. I alternate every week because I believe, you know, that's real important in our program. And I sponsor guys, and it's like as far as all the other stuff that I used to do, going to conventions and being involved in area and region, that stuff's kind of going by the wayside, and that little voice back there sometimes wants to talk to us and say that you're not good enough, you're not worth anything, you know. And the truth of the matter was, I'm still doing recovery. It's just in a different way, and I have to look at it. But ever since I got that phone call, I find myself getting more involved in some other meetings that I used to go to, and when I used hard. I went to the Bahamas for dope. I'd ring your phone off the wall until you answered. I'd walk wherever it took. I'd take your car if I had to get there. I need to have the same kind of passion about my recovery. And, you know, I have to be willing to ring your phone off the hook to live. I have to be willing to walk to a meeting. I have to be willing to fall on my knees when I get out of bed. I was willing to get on them to get out of bed so I could go get my dope. I need to be willing to fall on them so I can pray and say, get me through the day or help. Who is an addict? I can tell you who isn't an addict. They show up for work. They don't drink. If they do drink, they don't drink until the bar closes and then go try to find some beer somewhere else or some dope somewhere else. They don't lie to their family. They don't steal from their family. Who is an addict? I don't know. If you ever stop to wonder for even just a brief second whether you're an addict, it's probably a 99.9% chance you're an addict. Because someone who isn't usually doesn't ever stop to wonder. But my denial was real thick. I didn't ever want to really accept that. When I was young, my dad had a problem with gambling. Mom, she just hid from life. It was everybody else's fault. And I can remember going to resort for a 4th of July weekend. And I remember walking down to this lake and thinking, wow, this place is beautiful. Look at these houses. I'll never live somewhere like that. And that was like the mentality that I had through my earlier years. Like, I wasn't good enough. I didn't belong. I didn't fit. I wasn't capable. Just all the wrong messages. My first exposure was 2 years before I got clean. I got in some trouble with the law. And that was like my first experience with what the NA program is. And my girlfriend at the time found it necessary to inform my parents that I had a problem with drugs and alcohol. And through the family, they knew someone that came to these meetings. And that person agreed to meet me at a meeting. And that was my exposure. Sometimes that's how it works. There's a lot of ways that this program works. It didn't work for me that time. You know, I came to the meetings. I saw guys hugging guys. I heard people talking about God. And at that point in my life, I wasn't okay with God. I didn't believe there was God because he never gave me anything I ever asked for. And today I understand, you know, it ain't about asking God, you know, for things. It's more of, what can I do for you, God? How can I be of service? Because when we're in service to God, that's the greatest gift we can ever get. The rewards that come from doing it are just mind-boggling. As a result of my journey, I'm going to eventually tell you about that lake that I was at earlier with all those nice houses. But I went to a couple meetings and I just, you know, heard all the wrong things and went back out and I tried to stay clean on my own. And I fought it for about 2 years and I was humbled. And like she said earlier, God works sometimes when we're not really willing. I ended up arrested in front of my mother. 25 cops tearing her house apart. I was passed out on a couch from being up 24/7. And little old lady fighting with cops, trying to take a bag out of their hands, you know, that was some of her plants that they thought were, you know, some dope. And it was pretty humiliating being brought out of that house in a neighborhood that I grew up in, everybody seeing and watching. And I just remembered the trouble I got in 2 years earlier. My first question going out the door is, what's the name of a good rehab? Because I remember the judge last time said, go get help. So I figured I was going to beat him to all the punches and, you know, go get help before I got in front of the judge the next time. So he pat me on the back and say, you've been a good little boy. Don't let me see you again. And it didn't work that way. And that's really when I got the true exposure of the love and unconditional love and that exists in these rooms. I went to meetings and was getting notes signed when I didn't have to get notes signed. And I was talking about, well, actually I went to some rehabs. You know the funny thing about rehabs and halfway houses? Did you ever notice? Where do they always take us when we're in there? They always bring us here. They know the answer's here. They don't have it. Never dawned on me about that until, about 2 years ago. I heard someone share that, and it was like, wow. But anyways, I came out of those rehabs and I started coming to meetings and people told me get a home group, get a sponsor. And the only thing that was going through my mind back then was, how the F is that going to keep me out of going to jail? You know, because I had some serious charges on me, and they kept telling me to keep coming back, it's going to be okay. And I heard them say, it's going to be okay, and it always registered to me as, I ain't going to jail. 10 months and one day, reality set in. When the judge said, you're a scumbag, you should have been in jail 10 months ago. And off I went. When I was in those rehabs, there was a guy that came in to do H&I, and I can remember that man, and I thought, it's a Sunday afternoon. What the hell is he doing here at a rehab with a bunch of losers like us? By the time I got to the penitentiary, 2 weeks in, I got my first package. It was a set of books and some letters from people in the program. And my thought this time wasn't, why is someone sending me something when I'm a loser and worth nothing and sitting here in a penitentiary? It was the first time that I felt some self-worth despite where I was at. That package saved my life because the day that I was arrested, the only thought that was going through my mind other than how am I getting out of here is I might as well kill myself because I won't have a felony record. I'll never amount to anything. The 2 weeks prior to that package, I used to think on a daily basis, just jump off the rail and hit your head on that pavement. Get over with. You know, I failed to mention that whenever I went to trial, there was 25 people from NA showed up at my trial. Only 4 of them told me that they'd be there. They say that the ultimate weapon, you know, for recovery is another recovering addict. And, you know, through my journey, it certainly has been. I couldn't be here today if it wasn't for other people in my life, you know, in recovery. No matter what the case has been in my journey, other people have been there. When something in life happens, I don't have to try to deal with it alone anymore. I didn't do the penitentiary alone. People were at my trial when I was at the penitentiary. I had over 100 people that were writing me letters on a daily basis. When I came home from the penitentiary, people offered me jobs. Went to work. I got some bad news this morning. I forgot about that. One of the second jobs that I had in recovery, no, it's the third job I had in recovery, was someone that was in recovery. And I found out that she passed away. I'm not sure like exactly when. It was, I guess, in the last couple months. But they were holding a memorial for her this weekend, and I wasn't aware of that. When I got out, I ended up getting 3 home groups. I got 2 sponsors. That got corrected real quick because I was playing one against the other. And, you know, I was still trying to use people. And they taught me, you know, not to use people anymore. The very first thing I ever did as an assignment was, why are we here? I had to read that chapter and write an exercise on it, and then I had to define who my we was, and I named some names, and he got away with it with me because he knew that I had a higher power, and he kept asking me for names until I eventually said God. And today, that's the most important thing for me, because I know that all my life, all I ever did was turn my back on God. Today, I just try to be a vehicle and try to do the next right thing. When I went to the penitentiary, my big fear was my parents would die whenever I went away, and how would I handle that? Years later, I'm now, you know, in the position of a parent, power of attorney, taking care of them. And I had someone one time, I thanked them for being there whenever I was early in recovery. And they said, what'd I do? And they just caught me off guard. It was like I had to think, what did they do? And I realized I was just doing that people-pleasing thing that we do for the moment. And I really thought about the situation, and I called them back a couple days later, and I told that person what they did for me was they believed in me when I wasn't capable of believing in myself. Because whenever I went to the penitentiary, before I went to the penitentiary, I thought, what kind of life am I going to have? What's it ever going to amount to? I'm going to have a felony record. What am I going to be able to do? Work at Burger King the rest of my life? But that's that thinking that goes on between our ears, you know, and it's real dangerous in between there. And from sticking around here and sticking around here, I now have a job that I'm considered a doctor. I'm not actually a doctor, but I have all kinds of initials behind my name. And you know what? It's like if I go apply for something or if I want to try to switch careers, I'm not afraid today to go talk to someone on an interview. In fact, today, my mind, I sometimes have to try to shut it off on how do I start my own business? You know, as a result of sticking around here and working steps, I've been able to come full circle to the point that instead of I don't believe in myself and I feel worthless and hopeless, that I have confidence and I believe in myself and I know that I'm very capable. I just have to do the footwork. I never understood that I had to do the footwork and show up for life on a daily basis. I thought it was always supposed to be handed to me, or that it was your fault that I didn't get what I wanted. You know, today I know that I just got to show up to the plate, and God takes care of it. You know, I was involved. I worked hard. I eventually left Pittsburgh and I moved out into rural Pennsylvania in the early 90s. And that was culture shock because I went from a home group that we had like 400 people at, something like that, to a home group that had like 5 people. And that was crazy. And by the way, when I say about passionate about your recovery, I live in an area now that we don't even have a meeting in the town I live in. They all closed up. I have to drive 45 minutes one way to a meeting of NA. I have the willingness to show up for my recovery today. The H&I that I go into, I drive an hour and 15 minutes to the one meeting and I drive an hour and a half to the other one. When I was in the penitentiary, I couldn't get people to come in. My sponsor got in there once in all the times that I was in there. And when I was in there, I got to know some people that were doing life. I realized, you know what, I don't know why other than the grace of God that ain't me. It wasn't. And I knew that the day I was eligible to start doing H&I, I would, and I've been doing it ever since. Last month, I surpassed 10 years of being involved in H&I. And hopefully, a day at a time, I get another 10. NA has always been there. There's been a lot of pain through recovery. If you don't think, if you're new here and you don't have a nice black dress or black suit, first chance you get, go get one, because you're going to watch people die in here that you care about. 3 years ago, the sponsor, I really attribute to really, really getting deep with me in steps. I watched him die slowly for 13 months of cancer, and I was able to be there for him and get to some conventions before he died and hold his hand and him cry on my shoulder after he got off a stage at his regional convention. And he was outside in the hall crying, saying, "I just want one more chance." That stuck with me. Always has. I don't think about other people I know have died anymore. When I think about death, my first thought goes to him. And that's because so often through my journey to recovery, I've always taken life for granted. Tomorrow's not guaranteed, and I don't get two of me. I need to make the most of it. I need to wake up in the morning and do something with it. Not wake up at 3 in the afternoon, you know, like I used to. It ain't easy. I'm a morning person. I managed to get up today. And that's because recovery's taught me that. I feel like I'm all over the place tonight, so I'm just going to say that, because when Ursula was talking, she said about the trouble getting down here. When I come down every year, I usually plan on leaving like about 2 o'clock on Thursday, and I hit Baltimore, catch a meeting with some friends in Baltimore, and then drive down. I'm usually here, you know, and get a good night's rest. And a lot of stuff's been going on at work, and I never ended up getting out of work until like 5:30, and on the road, I think, until 7:30. And I didn't end up getting to sleep, I think, until probably like about, we got in bed about 3 o'clock, and I don't think I actually got to sleep until 5, and I was up at 7:30. So I feel like I'm standing up here with, you know, toothpicks in my eyes. And I feel like I'm all over the place today. When I moved to that rural town of Indiana and got involved in the groups, how I ended up there was a relationship. And I didn't tell you how I ended up getting arrested in the penitentiary. 30 days prior to getting arrested, I was involved with a lady, and she was she became pregnant, and she had the abortion. And when it was over, I was there, and she came out of the operating room. I asked her why she chose to have the abortion, and she looked at me straight in the eyes and said, "What kind of father would you have been?" And I don't know that was really her that said that day, because it was what I needed to hear at the right moment, because that's what led to me being arrested 30 days later. When I moved to that town in Indiana, I got involved with a lady, you know, and she had 2 kids within 3 months. Those 2 kids started calling me dad. When she had 18 months clean, she relapsed instead of going to a meeting for her key tag. And a couple months later, I came home from doing a 7th step with my sponsor, and I could hear what was going on at the door. And I knew what I was going to see when I got to the door. I walked up to the door anyways, and she was in there buck naked with another guy. And my first thought wasn't, go in there and kill him. My first thought is this what you want the rest of your life? Because see, what I got that day of working the 7th step with my sponsor was truth. Deeper understanding of truth. I always sold myself short, or felt that I deserved less than, and I always settled. And I walked away from that, though as painful as it was, I did walk away from it. And I, you know, used the program just like I was taught. Called my sponsor, talked about it, and a couple weeks later, where it took me in my thinking was, man, I'm in debt. I started blaming her because, you know, I used all my credit to buy the Christmas stuff and the Easter stuff or birthday stuff or whatever it was for school. And all this anger was coming out, and I started in between my ears. I know how she goes to work in the morning. I can hide right there. When she comes down the road, I pull out, block her, put the gun to her head, kill her, nobody will know. And that's like where my thinking went. And what got me through that was calling my sponsor, the guys that I sponsor, telling them what was going through my head, showing up at a meeting and talking about it, and you know what? It went away. And I eventually evolved to that point that I hated here in early recovery where I was praying for. Man, I hated that in early recovery. You know, I had those kind of thoughts about the cops that arrested me. Someone said, pray for him. I didn't want to pray for him. He's giving me a sign 5 minutes. Man, where my mind went with that is thank God 5 minutes. I can go get some rest. Today I know as a result of this program that I can get through anything in life as long as I show up and I talk about it and I don't do it alone. I don't ever have to do anything alone. And most importantly, you know, when I was listening to Ursula, the thing that struck out to me was about being victimized. When I came home from the penitentiary, I heard someone say, it's going to be okay. And I hated hearing that before I went to the penitentiary. And for the first time, I understood what it meant. Don't take that first one. And everything will be okay. Maybe not today. It will be okay, though. Just stay. Just stay. As a result of working steps, I've come to understand that there's another level of that. Don't take the first one. I don't have to bite into my own thinking. I don't ever have to be a victim again. Mainly what goes on in between my own ears, because I'm my own worst enemy. I victimize myself all the time with the way I think and things I can say to myself. I need to talk to myself in a loving manner today and not disrespect myself. You know, simply as what I stated earlier about not saying something like, I only have 30 days. I have 30 days. I have 18 years. I need to take credit for the things that I accomplish in my life, you know, and stop disrespecting it. I'm just going to end it up with a story that I got years ago. There's a farmer that had a horse, and the horse ran off, and the neighbors came over to console him of his loss, and he said, how do you know it was a loss? And a couple days later, that horse came back with another fine horse, and the neighbors came over to congratulate him of his great fortune. And he said, how do you know it's a good fortune? Next day, his son tried to train the horse, and he fell off and broke his leg real bad and was maimed. And the neighbors came over to console him and, you know, helped him with his son and said, we're sorry for your son's misfortune. And he said, how do you know it's a misfortune? A week later, the army of that country came through and took all the young men to fight a far-off war, which they were all killed. The farmer's son, owing to his lameness, was, of course, spared. So here's a silver lining in every cloud. And this program has taught me not to look at something as good or bad. It's taught me to just simply go through, because I don't have God's eyes. And I don't need to try to control things like I used to. There's many things I tried to control in this program. When I had 10 years clean, one of the guys I was sponsoring, someone took some of his stuff from a meeting and went to a parole officer and told a parole officer what was shared and got him jacked up. And I went off the deep end with anger and did all kinds of stuff trying to control the situation. And it was my mission to see that guy never, ever came back to NA again. And what I end up learning as a painful result is there's one difference between me and God. He never, ever once thought he was me. But I have many times tried to do his job. Today I try to stay out of his way and just simply be a vehicle. Thanks for letting me share.